Today is Thursday, July the 29th, 1999, and in Fireside Room this evening, we have Ann Peterson's session called Three-Part Invention, The Geography of Gods. Its number is 99-8. Let's listen in.
I'm Ann Peterson, and this is the third part of the series entitled Where in the World is God? I don't know if we've answered that by any means, but we've raised some interesting questions, and today we may do a little more specific talking about how God is in the world, specifically through the understanding of the Incarnation. I teach religion, theology in specific at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Barb Rossing just came up on the boat today and said that she'd been down to Nebraska for a few days and that 3,000 cattle died in the feedlots. So I'm not looking forward to going back to the Dakotas. I'm ready to see home, but I'm not excited to go back to Sioux Falls and to the heat and to all that. So I'm hoping that maybe the geography really does matter, doesn't it? So it's nice to see some of you came from a big group, I hear, from Delphi, Washington. So welcome up to Holden. Okay, we'll go ahead and get started then on this session. I would have had for each of these sessions, we've had a little musical form. I'll explain just briefly why this session is titled this way. The overarching metaphor for this is Where in the World is God? Variations on a theme. Each chapter is sort of a variation on asking the question, where in the world is God? And since I have a music background, I chose a musical form for each chapter. So for the first one that we did called Dissonance, we had some piano music played. And yesterday we had a scherzo played by two of the roadie girls. If you get to know Inga, Anna, and Sarah while you're up here, you sort of can't miss them. And we had a little piece played, and that was wonderful. And today we're looking at a three-part invention. How many of you are musicians know what a three-part invention is? Anybody? Okay. Three-part invention. The inventions are Bach's great creations. The two-part inventions aren't too bad, but the three-part ones are holy terrors for keyboard players. The first one I ever played was at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, where I went to college for 2 years. And it's three very separate voices that work on the little motif, but they weave together in really complicated and trying ways for the pianist's hand, because normally the two-part ones work really well because you have one hand for each part, but the three-part, you have three parts for two hands. So, and I hope the session today doesn't sound like three parts for two hands. So I'll try to make it three distinct voices, and we'll see what happens. Today I want to look specifically at how we ask the question, where in the world is God, related to this little phrase up here that I just put on the board that says, finitum capax infinity. I'm going to explain that for just a minute, and then we'll come back to it again later. During the Reformation, Luther's first and primary opponents, I teach Lutheran heritage, I did my dissertation on Luther. One of Luther's primary opponents, of course, were the Roman Catholics. But one thing he shared in common with Roman Catholicism, and I think that Lutherans still do, is that God is present fully in the physical. And his next most ardent opponents, in fact, one of the people he railed against a lot was a man named Ulrich Zwingli. Some of you may recognize that name. Zwingli was one of Luther's arch opponents, and in many of Luther's writings in the mid-1520s were against Zwingli, and Zwingli develops what we later call the left wing of the Reformation, what we now know as the Anabaptist tradition. Quakers, Mennonites, some Baptists, which are not usually thought of as highly liturgical or highly sacramental. If you think of Quakers, you don't think of going to Mass every Sunday and taking the Eucharist. So it's a very different form of Christianity that happens as a breakoff of the Reformation. Part of the conflict that Luther develops with Zwingli is precisely over this little phrase. And what Zwingli does is to insert the little Latin word, known. Finitum capax non infinity, which means the finite is not the bearer of the infinite. So Thankfully comes along and says, no, it's not this earthly, fleshly stuff that bears the infinite, but it's the spiritual realm. And he strongly emphasizes the divinity of Jesus. It's Christ as divine. And consequently, you have a highly spiritualized understanding of the sacraments. If you talk to people out of the Anabaptist or the left wing of the Reformation, and you talk about where Christ is present in the Eucharist, you don't have a doctrine of what we Lutherans call the real presence, or of Catholic transubstantiation, where Jesus is somehow really present in the elements, but you talk about it in much more of a symbolic or spiritual way. And so Luther gets in this big argument with Ulrich Zwingli about where Christ is present. Where is God in the world? And specifically the discussion centers around where is Christ present in the Eucharist? And Luther says, no, it's not some sort of spiritual presence, but it's a concrete physical presence of Christ in the earthly elements. Now, to ask Luther exactly what that meant, he said, that's not really my job. That's probably where he disagreed with the Catholics. He didn't want to get into a big discussion of Aristotelian metaphysics to talk about transubstantiation. But what he did say is that along with the Catholics, we would have a sympathetic understanding that Christ is fully present in the physical world. So if you talk about where God is present, for Luther, the sacraments were an important way to understand that God is fully present in bread and wine and in water. And not just in a, some sort of spiritual realm, but in very physical ways, so that when Luther talks about taking in Christ, he means that in a highly physical way. And of course, Luther was a very physical person himself. He was a down-to-earth, sometimes embarrassingly down-to-earth. If you know Luther's biography, he did all kinds of crass and crazy things, especially in his later years. But a very earthy man that valued the physical, concrete daily lives of people. So when we talk about knowing this little phrase, where is God in the world? One thing that Lutherans will claim is that Christ is always, that God is always incarnate in Jesus Christ in the physical. That is the finite, who we are, bears the infinite God. Okay, so there's not this stark opposition between the earthly and the spiritual. For Luther, it was precisely the earthly, concrete stuff of this world that bears God's presence. In fact, one of my colleagues talks about incarnation this way. God was incarnate in the world. If you eat chili con carne, you eat it with meat. Okay, so it's God in the meat, right? God in flesh. And I think we're still really good at somehow defleshing God. So this is an attempt to try to locate God deeply in the flesh, but to do it in our categories, to try to find out what that might mean for us. Okay, any questions so far? We'll come back to Luther down the road again and revisit that. Does that make sense? Okay, first place I want to talk about what it might mean to say that God is located in us is to talk about the actual physical category of geography. And to start with that, I want to use a couple, three different authors. One is Kathleen Norris. How many of you have read Norris's, know her stuff? Dakota, Cloister Walk, the new one,
Amazing
Grace, The Vocabulary of Faith, right? Mm-hmm. She's a wonderful writer. Yes?
There's one after that also now that's just out in from Paulus Press.
Oh, really?
And I can't think of the name of it, but it's available through Paulus.
Okay.
Just published.
Oh, great. I'll have to check and see what that is. It's amazing for I think, really profound writing. She's been hitting the New York Times bestseller list, and she makes the rounds through the Dakotas. We've heard her speak a couple of times. In her first book, Dakota, she uses the word geography, and she talks about it, of course, in a little bit different way by talking about it as writing of the earth. And she talks about looking at your spiritual geography, looking at where you've come, where you've been, and locating yourself by your spiritual geography, by literally placement. I had a long talk with Dan Spencer yesterday. He's one of the summer program coordinators. And he's also working on this theme in his own writing. And we talked about how when you come into a place, something physical happens to you. I get that way. There's a certain place, and then maybe you can start thinking of places in your own mind where those things happen. It's about 60 miles east of Bozeman, Montana. Some of you may know a little town called Big Timber. You get to Big Timber, Montana, and then you drive 50 miles due south, and you go straight into the Absarokee Beartooth Range. And there's a wonderful place that I spent most of my childhood, summer Bible camp, and then worked together with my husband, and it's a place called Christikon. And there's one particular hike that we would always take 2 miles up into the woods, lift an old prospector that I spent many years with, getting to know. And as you'd head up this hike, the first mile or so, there's a 1,000-foot elevation gain just in the first mile. So it was a tough hike. We get up there and visit this old prospector. And when I head south of Big Timber and up the Boulder Valley and up toward Charlie's, there's probably no place in my entire life that has felt more like home. Mm-hmm. It's also deeply rooted for me spiritual. I've hauled kids on backpacks and hikes and lots of Minnesotans all over from the Midwest through that part of the country as a camp director. Lots of things happened for me in my life during those years of testing boundaries, but it was also there that I had some of the most profound spiritual engagement, places that I really felt I located God's presence. And sometimes embarrassingly so, and I hate to admit this, but the church hasn't always been the easiest place for me to locate God. And I know there's a danger of saying, well, God's out in nature and we can just go golfing on Sunday. And that's not what I'm talking about. But the sense of place, I think we underestimate. So Dan Spencer and I were talking about this way that you take in, and maybe it's a smell. How many of you have certain smells that you identify with places? You can just get a waft of something, and you know right away where you're at. So I want you to think a little bit today as we talk about those places that you consider sacred space. And they don't have to be as dramatic as hiking up somewhere in the Absarokee Beartooth. It might be a place in your own house where you find just that you have a space every day that's sort of ritualized. My dining room table and my Airedale Terrier are my morning ritual of reading the paper and taking time to slow down. That even can be a place where you find a sacred space. And how that translates into church, we'll talk more about later. But geography itself, I think we underestimate how important that is for spirituality. So I want to read just a quote. I've not read this whole book, so I hesitate in even quoting him because it's not somebody I've read a lot. But Wallace Stegner, some of you may know his stuff. In the book Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, he has this wonderful quote about, in an essay called A Sense of Place. If you don't know where you are, says Wendell Berry, you don't know who you are. Okay. So I think one way you develop Luther's phrase about the finitum capax, the finite is capable of the infinite, is knowing where you've come from and what that means. I know as a person now living in the upper Midwest, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, my understanding of Lutheranism is really different experience than what I felt in Bozeman, Montana. For one thing, there are 9 million Lutherans in Sioux Falls. I think there are 18 or 20 Lutheran churches, as like counting them up, including Missouri Synod. And that's just in Sioux Falls. I'm not talking about the outskirts yet. In Bozeman, there were 2 Lutheran churches. And there was a couple Catholic churches and a Methodist church. And my understanding is that the farther you go west, the statistically, the more unchurched the United States is. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
So you can even see how that identity shifts in terms of where you might experience your own spiritual location. So he goes on to say, he is not talking about the kind of location that can be determined by looking at a map or a street sign. He is talking about the kind of knowing that involves the sense, the memory, the history of a family or a tribe. He is talking about the knowledge of place that comes from working in it all weathers, making a living from it, suffering from its catastrophes, loving its mornings or evenings or hot noons, valuing it for the profound investment of labor, and feeling that you, your parents and grandparents, your all but unknown ancestors have put into it. He is talking about the knowing that poets specialize in. And I like that quote because it's something that's almost not conscious. That's the kind of knowing I'm talking about that Norris, I think, looks at, is what are the places in your life, and now we can talk even more metaphorically, they don't even have to be geographical locations, but what spaces or people or experiences do you have that are sort of deeply rooted inside of you in almost a preconscious kind of way? Because I think those come up throughout your whole life as you begin to discover where you're at home in worship. I had a nice, quick, but wonderful chat with Susan Briel this afternoon. And we talked about going into some worship experiences and you just know you're home. The Osbornes are here. We shared a similar feeling for the Benedictines. You walk into a Benedictine monastery and somehow the worship there for me somehow hits home. And I have no idea where that is. I grew up Lutheran, I don't know why, but I think it's the love of liturgy, of the rhythm of things. Where for other people, going into that community feels foreign, strange, odd. But I think it's important to get a sense of your geographical location, your spiritual home. Another author that I would highly recommend to you if you need some, I don't think they have any of his writings up here in the bookstore. I should have ordered some. And I did a little bit with him 3 years ago. How many of you have read Ole Rolvag? You know Rolvag, Giants in the Earth. What's the second one?
Peter Victorious.
Peter Victorious, and the third one is Their Father's God. Rolvag, I first read Giants in the Earth. Oh, God, I'm trying to remember when I first read that. I reread it when my husband and I moved to South Dakota. When we got married, he was teaching in a little town right near Sioux Falls in Chester, South Dakota, and I said, hell will freeze over before I ever move back to this state. Well, I'm not sure what happened, but anyway, my first teaching job when we landed in South Dakota, and I've grown to appreciate it, but I also felt real sympathy for the character of Barrett. She and
Peter.
Right, move.
Per,
that's right, Per Hansa and Barrett move from Norway, of course, which probably looks sort of like out here, and they move to the Dakota Territory, probably near Gerritsen. And what happened to her, of course, she goes crazy because she's out on the Dakota Prairie. It's not her home. She feels unsafe, and the winds blow constantly. And I think Kathleen Norris also captures this. The Dakota Prairies are pretty harsh landscapes. How many of you are Midwesterners in here or have had that experience? I find the contrast in the Midwest is unbelievable. It's 90 to 100 in the summer sometimes with horrible humidity, and then in the winter it's 40 below and the winds blow just as strong either side of it. You can imagine how the immigrants felt when they came. I think we have forgotten probably in some of our memories how harsh of a lifestyle they probably had. And Rolvag captures this. I'd like to just read a little quote from Rolvag. Here he's talking about reaching the promised land of the Dakota Territories, but finding out it may not have felt like that. The hand of God lay heavy upon all, age-old words that had now become real. Pious people sought out their closets in secret and fear, and there behind shut doors sobbed for mercy from the lash of the Lord's wrath. Most of the settlers had neither the faith nor the courage to face crop failures and starvation. One after another, they were pulling up stakes. The whole country was scorched, every field burned up. Settlers had abandoned all hope of ever establishing homes in that place. As for him, he wouldn't give a cent for the whole goddamn prairie. The man raged, desperation burnt in his eyes. Rather strong words, but one of the things that Augustana faces as a community are those seasons in which the farmers have gone through incredible seasonal difficulties. Mm-hmm. And I know one thing that the Lutheran Church now is doing is putting sort of listening posts into the small rural communities, where the land really is shaping the faith of people. The suicide rates are going up. Battered domestic violence in homes, particularly in rural areas, is increasing a lot. when the land itself takes the toll on people. And you can imagine the kind of desperation that many of the people felt during those times. So the very notion of promised land or place can be an ambiguous category. It can be a wonderfully nostalgic, like thinking back to my childhood of Charlie and the wonderful mountains. But place can also be highly ambiguous. The notion of immigrant, there's a piece out in the, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, in one of the journals out there, America, which is a good Catholic periodical, on the issue of immigration. And that's one thing that Rolbaugh is raising is, now here's, this is only about a century ago. And immigrants are now having the same problem again, aren't they? Sioux Falls is now a community again of immigrants. A large number of Sudanese, of former Soviet Union, different republics. There are 40-some languages now spoken in the Sioux Falls public schools. And of course, the interesting thing is that for a lot of us, we forget, unless it's in your immediate past, that most of us came from immigrant families. My grandfather immigrated from Sweden, and I don't think his life was pure luxury all the way across. I know it was very difficult. And that says something, I think, if we can think about, from my own history anyway, to know who we are, we must know where we are, to understand that pattern of immigration in your life, and to know the difficulties and pains and issues that goes with, may help us to try to locate some spiritual empathy for those that are now immigrants in a land that's probably just as harsh, just as frightening from where they've come from. I kind of gathered that the Sudan doesn't look a bit like Sioux Falls. So people are dislocated. That's a phrase that we usually think about joints. You know, you've dislocated your knee. It's a very painful experience I've never had anything dislocated, but I can imagine it's a very painful experience. That same kind of dislocation is what we can talk about with those people in the world who have experiences of not finding a place. So I think the category of place that you hear out of Rolbaugh, Norris, and Stegner has both very positive connotations. That is, locating your spiritual history, calling to mind those places that you consider sacred. But it also has, I think, an ambiguous or more troubling notion of being dislocated. Mm-hmm. Finding experiences of where location is extremely ambiguous. Yes?
When you talk about ambiguity and dislocation, I think of the folks who now a second generation of unchurched, and yet a longing for some expression of their spirituality, not even having a vocabulary to ask for what they want.
Now, a lot of people are coming into congregational life without maybe three generations of being Lutheran or Regents or whatever, right? Yeah, and so it's finding even the language of the community that you've inherited.
There's a kind of immigration. I mean,
yeah.
That same notion of isolation and a new place.
Yeah.
Immigrants.
And finding how the church responds to that.
Right.
That's a good example. Yeah, Paul.
A nun told me recently that there's some research in the Catholic Church that is identifying the attachment to certain sacraments and rites based on the geography of a person's background.
Really?
So the people who grew up next to the ocean have a deeper attachment to baptism.
Huh.
This particular nun grew up at the coast and now lives in the Minnesota Prairie. And she did a graduate study at Loyola and said if her room hadn't odored like Michigan, she didn't know what she'd do.
Yeah.
Because she so desperately needed to see the water. And I grew up in the South Dakota Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
Wind is very powerful to me, as is confirmation.
Spirit. So you get the spirit movement.
Yeah, that movement of the spirit. It's. I've not read the research, but it was a fascinating research.
Yeah, I think you do have some connection with certain elements or rituals or things that may have very deep geographical and familial roots, too.
Yeah.
And I think place It'd be interesting to do more with that, with sacrament and place and knowing where people come from. I never thought about that. It's a whole nother category. And after talking with Dan Spencer this week, the other thing that I've not thought enough about was the whole question of ecological location as part of our geography. To understand that little phrase, to know who we are, we must know where we are and where we've come from. We come from how many billions of years history? My interest in religion and science plays into this in terms of understanding that we're products out of how many millions and millions of years to understand who we are. If I can find one little quote about that, I think, you know, you try to figure out, this is sort of locating yourself not only as a person in this generation, but locating yourself as related to the entire cosmos. This is one of my favorite quotes from a man named Loyal Rue. Some of you may know Loyal. He teaches at Luther College in Decorah. He says, imagine being told after all these years that the woman who runs your neighborhood deli is in fact your sister. Would that information make a difference to you? Of course it would. In a similar way, the epic of evolution has the potential to affect the manner of our beholding and intersecting with the entire natural world. Never mind the lady at the deli, you're genetically related to the sandwich she sells you. I just love that quote. I mean, there is something about locating yourself within the place of evolution. And one of the best pictures I've seen for that, I'm going to erase Martin Luther's name since you all know that, is sometimes I think we think of ourselves on a journey. That's kind of a contrast to what I'm talking about in place, but Christians have often used the notion of a journey. But somebody thought of that in a little bit different way. If we think of where we are now as one of the stations on a train, we think of evolution or the movement of God going through us. In other words, we're not on the journey, but it's God who's on a journey through us. And I think that's a little bit different metaphor. It's like being at the train station in Wenatchee and the train's coming through. It's already been somewhere and it's going through. And we're one moment in God's journey. We're not the end point by any means.
There was a teacher in the village several years ago whose form of asking your question, he was teaching ecological justice, was to say, if you don't know where it goes when you flush the toilet, you don't know where you are. Right, I think about that in terms of passing through. Right? If you live on a river, you can be sure it goes downstream.
Right.
And you are ecologically related to the forest downstream.
Right.
But technology has helped us not be attentive to that.
Exactly. And I think this whole concept of our relatedness to the world has dramatic impact for this notion of geography, because then it expands our place in the world. Yes.
And I think certain regions have almost icons or symbols of where they live that just sort of touch the heart of each person there.
Mm-hmm.
When we were talking in the Seattle area about the spotted owl, that didn't really touch that many people. We were talking about we've got to protect habitat for the spotted owl.
Mm-hmm.
But say the word salmon, and everybody in Puget Sound knows to their bone what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are certain symbols. The buffalo surely in our part of the country has symbolized that for, I think, cultures.
And the loon.
And the loon, Minnesota loon. Mm-hmm. You know, all those sort of things that come up that somehow connect with our place. I think that's helpful. Dan and I talked about that more at length because the work I did on this initially was more structured around sort of geography and place, and I think that needs to be expanded again to include place within our understanding of cosmic evolution. You know, I love the notion that the elements of the stars that were created millions and billions of years ago are now genetically part of who we are. 99% of the DNA of chimps, we talked about this yesterday, is the same DNA that we have. So we're within the place of God's way of working in the world. And it's a wonderful way, but I don't think we often think of our place in the world as being such a vast movement. And consequently, it does relativize things a little bit. It makes you think that there are things to come that we have no idea what that might be. And there were billions and millions of species that gave their lives, in a sense, for our evolution. So it's an interesting way to think about that.
Just as a little piece that just kind of connected to some degree, I've been reading a lot of Meister Eckhart.
Oh, okay.
Over the last few weeks or so. And his whole sense of interrelatedness was amazing. And his whole sense, too, that, I mean, every being, that some sense of God flows out of, that there's just this kind of almost enmeshed nature.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then, you know, you talk about place, you know, and guess who popped out of almost the same place where Eckhart was walking up to this Lutheran. And here's the guy who's saying, God's in my cabbage soup.
How right.
You know, he's not. Yeah. You know, and it's just so, I mean, it almost comes full circle back into placing it.
Yeah, the language of interconnectedness or web or enmeshment is, I think, used a lot now in scientific communities to talk about the interrelatedness of life. What's that, the physical principle, somebody can help with me, the Lorentz effect, where, I mean, I think it's been possibly misunderstood, but where the butterfly flaps its wings in Peking, the effects are felt in the clouds in the United States, that contemporary physics has seen things that interrelated. So I think that's a little bit what you're connecting with, too. Okay, are we ready to head to Luther? Okay, I want to come back to this notion of what we were talking about with the Tennant and Papax and Luther's discussion. It's a funny little discussion. He has this whole argument about where you locate God. But I want to read a quote from a theologian, Vilmos Vaite. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. I might be bludgeoning it. But a little book that I read in seminary a long time ago called Luther on Worship. And what he's trying to say is that for those of us who use spatial language, where in the world is God? Well, lots of us talk about that God is not in the world. If you think of a lot of our spatial language, God is up here, the world is down there, and somehow we talk about God up there, out there, distant from. In last week's session, we even talked about, I call it the Bette Midler theology. God is watching us from a distance, you know. That's not Christian. It surely might be pop culture, but it's not Christian theology. That somehow God is sort of out there someplace. And then there's language in Scripture which talks about that. But once you start talking Christologically, or God in Jesus, the language, I think, shifts a bit to talk about God in the flesh. So here's Vita's little comments. He says, God's redemptive warfare goes on in the world as his word is preached and sacraments granted. Thus, the fallen man is led back to the gifts of creation. He is returned to, not removed from the earth. For it was the devil who diverted man from the earth, where God is to be in some imaginary heaven where he is not. That's pretty interesting language. So it's the devil who tempts us to think that God is up in some imaginary heaven. And Vita says, well, God isn't there. He prompted man to seek God, per se, instead of within his earthly existence. In other words, the temptation is to see God out there somewhere, or in another world, in another existence. Where is God? Well, God's really out there somewhere, especially when I get to go to heaven. That's where God will really be. And that's, at least for Luther, near blasphemy. The notion that God is somewhere removed out there in some further existence and isn't somehow concretely embedded in the world now. So then he says, but it is here that God contends for the salvation and redemption of all of us. It's right here, right now, right in this moment, in this concrete particularity. So I'll talk more about that on Saturday. He does not sit on his throne in splendid isolation from the troubles of this earth, but shares them in Christ. I like that little sentence. God does not sit somewhere on a throne in splendid isolation. In other words, the picture, at least that I grew up with God as a child, and you see it in a lot of Sunday school material and a lot of our language, somehow God is sitting up there on a throne somewhere, sort of looking down at us. And Luther, at least Lutherans, challenged that understanding by saying then somehow we remove God out of the world. It's easy to ignore the concrete, physical, messy problems of the world. If God has anything to really do with the world, and if salvation is only spiritual, then it's really easy to think that, well, the real purpose of Christianity is just that I get me and Jesus and I get saved and go to heaven. And instead, Luther has a very this-worldly emphasis. Not that he doesn't talk about eternal life in heaven, but you can only understand heaven or spiritual or afterlife if you fully understand first that God is physically present in this world.
Is that Luther you're quoting?
No, this is Vilmos Vida. Okay. That's a Lutheran theologian.
But
he's drawing on Luther.
Drawing on
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Luther does speak of the hidden God.
Right.
But what he says about that hidden God is that the only thing we know about that God is a God of wrath, a God of vengeance, and a God of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's the revealed God, you know, in Christ that is the God of mercy and the God of grace.
Right.
And the God of compassion. So that in seeing the distant, and I think if you know you think about some of our Christian tradition and even our own heritage as Lutherans, you know, God being out there mm-hmm. is a God that's a little bit more fearful.
Right.
You know, none of us are afraid of Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
Know,
at least
for the most part. I mean,
right.
You know,
right.
In that sense of growing up, I mean, you know,
right.
Jesus is a different picture.
Jesus is the friend, the comforter that.
Yeah, right. Is a different picture than say the God that we really don't know about, the hidden.
Luther uses actually two forms of what you're talking about. That in Latin is the Deus Absconditus, the God hidden, and then the Deus Revelatus, the God revealed. He uses that actually in two different ways. One is the way you're talking about, the God who appears hidden, and he even uses language in the bondage of the will, and this is where I just part company with Luther. Luther says God is not even bound to God's promises in the God apart from Jesus Christ. And that's the God that we meet as the wrathful God, the God who appears to us as the judge, the external God out there. And the God that we know, of course, is the God who's revealed in Jesus. But the Deus Absconditus is the God of wrath, the God that we fear. Okay, that's one language that he uses. Then he also talks about the hidden God as God revealed under God's opposites. And he draws under that language of God subcontraries, the God mm-hmm. revealed in the opposites. Mm-hmm. So that when you see the powerful and the wealthy, you look to the opposite. To the poor, to the lowly, that's where you find God. So he uses that in kind of a paradoxical way. What he says is that if you move away from this hidden, wrathful God to the God in Jesus, that God in Jesus is yet hidden again under God's opposites. So you don't look for the all-powerful, what I call the Big Ten God, you know, the football God, God. Instead, what you find is God hidden under God's opposites. Or under the world's opposites. It's that notion of power made known in weakness. You know, God not in the rich and the powerful, but in the weak and the lowly. So again, Luther sort of turns that on its head and says, you know, we find God revealed in Jesus, but Jesus as the one who has suffered, the Jesus who knows the weak, the poor. Okay? So it's another way of locating God in the finite world. In the same book, Bondage of the Will, Luther talks about locating God in each other, and he uses the language of little Christ. We become little Christ for one another. So that's another place that Luther makes this very concrete, is that you know Christ in your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And I think Lutherans have to expand that a little bit to include all of creation. But you can talk about, well, where is it that you look for God in the world? And Luther would say, in the neighbor, and in particular, the neighbor who is hungry, who needs clothes. He uses really interesting language in Bondage of the Will. He talks about Christians becoming cooperators with God. For some Lutheran theologians, that sounds scandalous. But
talks about us becoming co-authors. That is, he says, we become the hands and feet of God. Mm-hmm. In a sense, we're pretty necessary for God to get what God needs to get done in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty finite kind of knowing. We're absolutely necessary for God to get God's will done. Luther says that faith, in a sense, is becoming the feet and the hands of God as we act on behalf of the poor and the needy and those who are suffering and in pain and grief.
How is that different from the co-creator concept of Matthew Fox popularized?
I don't know Matthew Fox's work. I know the term co-creator through Philip Hefner's work. Mm. And he uses it in the language of the created co-creator, where he talks about the fact that co-creator always needs the word created with it, otherwise we think we're equal with God. And I think Luther would use, and I think Matthew Fox is in similar sympathy with Hefner and with Luther in the sense that in creation, we're given the responsibility of, it's more of a partnership or a relational language. And I think Lutherans sometimes have had a tradition of not being comfortable with that, because if God does everything in God's grace, we're sort of the passive recipients of faith, and you know, all we have to do is sort of accept God's grace, but we really don't have to do anything. And this language of co-creating, it's been picked up in a very Lutheran way in Hefner's work of created co-creator, is the notion that... Created co-creator. He wants us to remember that we're
created.
Yeah, that we're first of all creatures. But then out of that creatureness, we develop a partnership with God. And it's very... His is driven by the notion of an ethical responsibility in the world. I mean, in other words, faith makes a difference. It's not just sort of this passive receptivity of sort of belief, you know, God does everything and I sort of believe and that's it. But it's this very relational thing. It's surely first that God, in God's grace, enables me. It's not, we're not talking about a works righteousness kind of thing. And neither was Luther. This comes out of faith. So the cooperating with God is not something that you do to get grace. I'd be using that in the wrong context. But the cooperation comes out of the act of faith. So faith itself is this act of moving in and with the creation. And I like Luther's language with that because I think it locates our responsibility in creation. Mm-hmm. Is that similar to Fox? I know his stuff only by sort of secondary.
I think he makes a bigger deal of the divine within us.
Okay.
I think. Mm-hmm.
And probably in a sympathetic way, I mean, Luther uses pretty strong language, and maybe I should use Luther's own words here. I'm trying to find this wonderful little... Luther says, therefore, indeed, God must be present in every single creature, in its innermost and outermost beings, on all sides, through and through, below and above, before and behind, so that nothing can be more truly present and within all creatures than God with God's power. That kind of says it all, doesn't it? And it starts, interestingly enough, with creation. So that where God is located in the world, where do you find God? Well, God is obviously present, first of all, in all of creation. Now that can drive us, Luther says, to the hidden God, because of the problem of evil, and we can have a whole weird discussion about this. But you can see that when you look out in the world, if you look in the world, it could... How do you know that God is for you? So that's where Luther says, secondly, then, we know that God is present for us in Jesus. And that's, of course, where the sacraments are so important, because they're promises that we know there God is present for us. And it's a very particular for us, not just a generic for anybody. But it's for you. Mm-hmm. So Luther talks about God present for us. He says, this is God's right hand when it enters into the humanity of Christ and dwells there. So Luther also has a strong emphasis in contrast to his spiritual warfare opponent Zwingli, who talks about Christ as being spiritual or divine. Luther uses the emphasis of Christ's humanity. In fact, he even says, contra to theology at that time, that God suffers in Jesus. There is that wonderful heresy, what is it, Patripassianism, which says that God the Father can't suffer. Mm-hmm.
But Luther says if God really is God in Christ, Jesus isn't some sort of junior deity. Jesus is really God. God's self takes the suffering into God. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing for Luther. He says, there you will surely find it. Otherwise, you will run back and forth through all of creation, groping here and groping there, and that you never find, even though it is actually there, but it is not there for you. So he's very clear that you could run around looking everywhere trying to find God. But it is God who comes in the humanity of Jesus that we understand God's promise for us. Now, for some people, that might, and my fear is that with Matthew Fox, that might be too, I don't know Fox well enough, might be too Christological, might be too focused on Jesus, I don't know. But for Luther, this had strong, he was arguing for what he felt was at the heart of Christianity, that you can't find God just spiritually or out there, but located strongly in us. Yes?
Elie Wiesel writes really movingly about that from the Jewish perspective, mm-hmm. too, because of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, where is God in this?
Well, in that book, Night, he says, you know, mm-hmm. God is hanging in that scene where the child is hung. Right, right.
The little boy that's being hanged.
And, of course, Jesus even asks the question, where in the world is God, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. It's a question of you know, we always talk about this with my students. One of the, at least in the Gospel of Mark, the last words of Jesus is, my God, where, why have you forsaken me? In other words, where in the hell are you?
Right.
You know, literally. And I think sometimes we sort of clean that up by saying, well, Jesus really knew he was going to be resurrected, and, you know, he somehow knew ahead that God really was there. Well, I'm not convinced of that at all, and neither is Luther. If you understand Jesus as fully human,
right.
then I think we understand what divinity means. I think, see, there's this little contradiction. If we divinize or make Jesus clean and superhero, then he can't really take on
right.
full humanity. But somehow, if God is located fully in the human situation, then that cry that Jesus has really means something. It means Jesus fully embodies that. One of my favorite theologians, Gregory of Nazianzus, well, I haven't read that much of his stuff, but one of the Cappadocian fathers, who is drawn on heavily, incidentally, by Kathleen Norris, says, what is not assumed cannot be healed. Mm-hmm. What he says is, he means that about Jesus. What Jesus cannot take into Jesus' self mm-hmm. cannot be saved. So in order for Jesus to save everything, Jesus has to fully take on the human condition. Because the church history is full of places where we try to say, well, Jesus was, you know, human, but not this part of him. You know, maybe his mind was human, but his body wasn't, or his body was, but his mind wasn't, or his spirit wasn't. Or the church is full of heresies trying to say, well, God was in Jesus, but not really. And Gregory of Nazianzus comes along and says, unless Jesus fully takes on the human condition, it can't be saved.
Right.
So then you have to, then there's this full location or incarnation, so that incarnation becomes flesh in its fullness, every experience of the human condition, which I think really radicalizes the notion of incarnation.
Yeah. For me, it also radicalizes the notion of Jesus' obedience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in that sense, he doesn't really know everything. And in a sense, see, that makes divinity more interesting to me. If being divine means snapping my fingers and getting it all right, or Jesus, you know, in other words, it's going back to this notion of the Deus Absconditus, of God being hidden under the opposites, of divinity being hidden in the humanity. So if we want to know what divinity looks like, we look to the suffering of God. So I think that tends to twist that around. Yes?
The incarnation or the full humanity of Christ, in addition to being the way in which Jesus can save us,
mm-hmm.
is it also the way in which Jesus reveals the fullness of humanity?
Sure. Yeah,
that
exactly.
That he invites us to a human potential
mm-hmm.
that far exceeds our normal understanding of human.
Yeah. That's a nice way of putting it. I've read in, I think, John Cobb's theology, where he says, the more fully you are, the more fully human you are, the more fully divine you are. I think it's in Orthodox theology, this concept of theosis. Am I on the right track? That you become Jesus becomes human in order that we might become divine. And if you're here, it's not divinity in some sort of weird spiritual sense.
Yeah. One of the ways, one of the intersections for me with that is that in baptism as Lutherans, we understand that the Holy Spirit sanctifies us. And that has taken on meaning for me to become more fully human is part of becoming mm-hmm. sanctified.
Right. It doesn't mean rejecting your humanity. Right. Right.
Or being really, really good.
Good, right. Yeah, but at least living fully where you are in your life at that moment. Yeah.
He's grasping the image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, digging in and finding the image, and is the image of God within us.
Right. The Imago Dei, is that, where do you locate that in?
Clearly in, you know, who we are in relationship.
Okay, I'm going to just take a couple minutes to hint, for I think there's another interesting discussion. I was labeled today the wanton eclectic.
Yeah.
So here's my eclecticism coming through. Occasionally I read Fallon's Philosophy of Science. Well, I think all things come back to your spiritual geography. I couldn't figure out why I was so attracted to feminist philosopher science. Outside of enjoying feminist thought, what I'm realizing is that a lot of feminist philosophers are fighting the same battle that Luther did in the Reformation against Zwingli, but now they're doing it against a certain kind of science that's practiced with what they're criticizing is the objectivity. Pure knowing something as a pure object in which it's out there someplace and you're detached from it.
Right.
And in which the universal, it's a universal position, so that everybody has sort of a universal truth. And it's jokingly called the view from nowhere. If you sort of look out, you know, and one feminist philosopher of science calls it the God's eye trick. That is looking at everywhere, but in actuality, it turns out to be the view from nowhere because it's not embodied. And of course, the view from nowhere, that is leaving your biases out of the picture, has created a science which forgets particularity. And that's the feminist critique of science, of course, is that it's forgotten the bodies of women, of people of color, mm-hmm. So that what feminist philosophers of science are saying is that we need to make science very concrete, okay? Taking the human subject very seriously. A little phrase that a friend of mine says kind of summarizes that well. Where you stand determines what you see. So if you stand a certain place, there are certain things that you miss out of your peripheral vision. And what you need to do is learn to see from the standpoints of other people, because they'll help you get a bigger picture. In other words, you get the big picture by taking in the views from other people. And it helps what they call situate or locate knowledge.
Yeah. Well, St. Paul says that, you know, the hand can't do without the eye.
Yeah. This is the same exact kind of metaphor, right? That's a helpful comment. So that you gain more, ironically, the very objectivity they're saying, don't throw out the word objectivity. You become more objective with the more perspectives you get.
Right.
So it's a really interesting discussion between feminist philosophy of science, and they're using language about location and about finiteness and about particularity. And they're using the same vehemence and passion that I think Luther was working with against Zwingli. Which is to say, the incarnation, or God in the flesh, and I'll just hint at that conversation. I'm not going to spend any more time on the feminist philosophy of science. If you want to look at it, check out Donna Haraway and Sandra Harding and Barbara McClintock. I mean, there are all kinds of wonderful people using this material. But I just want to sort of, and we'll have a couple minutes for discussion, to say, what does that mean theologically for me about where God's located? First, is that the incarnation is what I call more than show and tell. Okay, sometimes we talk about God in the flesh as, well, it shows us who God is. Well, it does more than that. It really tells us that God is present in each of us. So the incarnation for me is God in very particular places for us. It's that Lutheran sacramental language of for us. The other thing is that God's grace is mediated in all of creation. We need to keep expanding Luther's category of the neighbor to include, I think what Paul talked about, the whole ecological niche in which we live. And finally, and I picked this up from a theologian whose name is now Paul Felix, is an Oxford scholar, and he says that God's incarnation is a promise. It's like a mm-hmm. vow you make with a partner that you're never apart from God. Mm-hmm. See, I think Luther finally discovered that, right? Well, where is God for us? The incarnation is finally a promise. It's like that vow you make to somebody that you are never, ever apart from God's presence. So that no matter where you are in your worst moments, in your best moments, whether you're an immigrant, whether you're dislocated, see, that would be the good news, is that no matter where you are, you know that somehow God has taken your location up into God's self and made it God's own.
Yeah. It's yeah. becoming comfortable with the ambiguity. And there's the absconders. I mean,
yeah.
becoming comfortable with the God that's hidden.
Right.
I was talking with a young man that's going into seminary, and we were talking, he was just railing against diversity. Mm. Can't stand it. And he said, pretty soon it's so, I mean, what do you know? And I realized, you know, we're talking about two different no's. I mean, there's the kind of no which science has been tracking along that says the no grasp
yeah.
and then can use. Mm-hmm. There's that standing outside of versus the more biblical understanding, or even in the languages, there are two different words where no means I'm going to be in relationship
right.
with you. Mm-hmm. You know, do I trust my neighbor? Well, can I use my neighbor? Mm-hmm. Or no, hey, I know Joe. Been with him for a long time. And there's a whole different kind
right.
of a sense
of knowing.
And once again, being able to stand kind of on that gray. And
yeah. just... I like your example, and I think the interesting thing for me, and we talked about this a lot yesterday, science itself is changing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that the way we know is a participatory experiment. I mean, you listen to the subject, the way contemporary physics is talking about knowing mm-hmm. things, the observer changes the experiment itself, all those kinds of wonderful things. Make epistemology knowing very embodied.
Yeah. Would you just come in to Zwingli for a second and summarize
yeah.
his position? It's over against Luther.
I think you can see it sort of in sort of common discourse. The passage that they argued over was John 6. You know, Christ saying, drink my blood, eat my flesh, I'm in you. And Zwingli says that's metaphorical. Because if Jesus is at God's right hand, and he's using the spatial language, how can Jesus also be present in the sacraments?
Mm-hmm.
And he has such a strong emphasis on the divinity of Jesus. So the physical stuff of this world is what keeps us from God. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in certain religious movements that move themselves out of the physical world. In certain Hutterite communities, places where they withdraw from the world, they try to get away from the earthly elements. You know, when we were in this Roman Catholic congregation, I mean, working the bingo parlor was part of knowing where God was in the world. You know, it was a very earthly, fleshly God in this world. So what Luther's trying to say is that instead of distrusting the physical, what we say is that, and he makes the argument that Jesus is God, precisely because of Jesus' humanness. Therefore, when you talk about God being present at God's right hand, God is also present in technical Lutheran language, it's the doctrine of ubiquity.
Yeah.
God is present everywhere all the time, but for us in the sacraments through Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Sovereignty was so key, too.
Huh?
Sovereignty was so
right.
key. Because you can't be sovereign if you're...
If you're located somewhere in this. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a stronger emphasis on what I would call the transcendence, the sovereignty, the otherness of God, where Luther is much more immanence, inside, mm-hmm. physical. And you can see it as it plays out in the piety that we have in our sacramental practices. I think that's why Lutherans are much more at home. Some of us Lutherans are much more at home with Roman Catholicism, Episcopalianism, than we are with certain aspects of the left wing and the right wing. Now, we need to listen to those folks because there are things that they're telling us. Sometimes we've become too enmeshed in culture.
Right.
So we need that voice. It's not that they're, Luther thought they were wrong. We have all kinds of horrible condemnations in the Book of Concord, our Lutheran confessions, but I think we can talk in different ways than that now. So. It's 6:00. I vowed I wouldn't go over. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to talk with me afterwards, but I'll let you go at this point. Tomorrow, we're going to look at the really sticky issue for me, which is my heart and soul question. How do you talk about God in the face of radical evil? So that'll be sort of tomorrow's session, and then Saturday we'll wind it up with what I call God in the particular. How do you just talk about God in your daily life? What's that mean? So tomorrow, if you want to upward at 10:45, we'll look at God and evil. Okay? All right, thank you.
You're from the dining hall. Hmm? You're in the dining hall. You're on the art.